Whenever you're ready, Mr. Delaferro.
Good morning. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Richard Delaferro. I represent the appellant Robert DeFreitas, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
As I'm sure the court is well aware reading the briefs, this case involves two convictions that are grounded in an allegation of violation of Virgin Islands Code Title 14, Section 403.
Mr. Delaferro, could I ask you, just because I think it might be an orderly way to proceed here, if we could begin with your request for certification, because clearly if we were to decide to certify, then we don't have to go on to resolve the merits here. The official act issue is inextricably intertwined, however, with any determination or any discussion, I should say, of the certification question. So you have asked us to consider certifying the question to the Supreme Court of the Virgin Islands. Why does the Supreme Court of the Virgin Islands sit in a better posture or in a more appropriate posture to determine the question of official act here than do we, especially in view of the fact that it is the federal court system, and in particular the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court, that has held forth specifically and most recently on the contours, if you will, of what an official act is?
Well, Judge, what I argued obviously was in the alternative, that that this court is in a position to determine whether the statute is void for vagueness in light of McDonnell, in light of Section 201 under the United States Code, and the precedent of Fierro, which I submit is a different type of statute.
Well, while there is some dictum and arguably important dictum in McDonnell on the issue of official act, the Supreme Court did not hold that particular statute or that the term official act was void for vagueness there, correct?
That's true, and that's because the statute, the Section 201, clearly delineates the elements, if you will, and the elements that eventually appear in the jury instructions regarding question or controversy and those specific elements. And the Virgin Islands statute just has none of that. It has no definition whatsoever. So it's markedly different than the bribery, the federal bribery statute, although they use the same phrase, official act. So it's the very same phrase, but it's undefined under the Virgin Islands Code, unlike the United States Code, where it's specifically defined.
Well, and in fact, official act and jurisprudence over official act actually has resonance and appears in the common law, doesn't it?
Well, it does.
If we taste this back far enough.
Right. Well, and I submit that Birdsall does give some indication of that, that settled practice can be viewed in determining whether an official act, there was a duty to perform an official act.
So what I'm getting to is that there is nothing particular to this Virgin Islands statute that really provides any reason for why the Supreme Court of the Virgin Islands should give shape or definition to this term as opposed to this court.
Well, and certainly I've asked this court to review the statute under the void for vagueness doctrine. And I argued in the alternative that this court felt that this was something that was better left to the local Supreme Court to interpret its own statute, that the court could do that in the alternative.
Let me ask something further here about certification procedure, because the Supreme Court of the Virgin Islands, of course, has a specific rule, Rule 38, that governs certification. When was the earliest time that certification could have been raised here by your side?
Well, it could have been raised pre-trial. The request for certification could have been raised pre-trial.
All right. And certainly both sides here knew that whatever the meaning or shape of official act was going to be an issue during trial, right?
It would appear from the record, yes, Your Honor.
From a policy standpoint, isn't the fact that the parties proceeded, not simply you, but also the government, that the parties proceeded with knowledge, presumably, that official act was going to be, if not central, a very important issue here as to one of the statutes, that you could and should have raised it, and now you are raising it only after you have failed to prevail at trial. Isn't that a factor, perhaps not a dispositive factor, but a factor that this court should take into account as we go through, in every case, a certification determination?
Well, I conceded that the issue could have been raised pretrial. It was raised after the conviction.
Understood. But actually, I should have been a little bit more refined in my question. Do you agree that as a matter of legal policy and of case administration, that it is a permissible consideration for this court and probably a consideration we ought to take into account as to whether or not a party has sought certification at the earliest available time, as opposed to at a point when the party has actually lost, either on the issue or to some extent as a consequence of the resolution of the issue?
Well, I can understand why the court's concern in the timing of the request for certification. I fully appreciate that. But I don't see anything in either this court's rules or in the Supreme Court of the Virgin Islands rules that puts a bar on the timing, as to the timing of raising the request for certification.
Understood. I don't want to monopolize the question.
The question might not even be a bar, but as a practical matter, it's certain that be something we should consider, the fact that you go to try, you lose, and then say, oh, by the way, folks, we need to let the Virgin Islands Supreme Court answer this question. Is that something should be considered?
Well, I would say this, that the request for certification was made post-trial during the period of time that a motion for a trial or judgment of acquittal was permitted under the rules of
Well, but that's well after a jury's been instructed, right?
Well, I agree. But I'm saying that the district court had an opportunity. It wasn't just left to the appellate court to certify the question. The district court had an opportunity to consider it and chose not to. So I think that in that respect, well, maybe we're in a little bit of a different posture than just simply it's raised for the first time on appeal. But, you know, going to the policy of why, you know, it's important, and I think the rules recognize this and the case law recognizes this, is we're talking about a Virgin Islands law that the Supreme Court of the highest court in the territory has not had an opportunity to opine upon.
I understand that, but let me take this one step further. Would it make any sense for the Virgin Islands, or any state for that matter, to define the very short-term official act in a manner different from the way it has been defined under a federal statute?
I don't I can't imagine that the Supreme Court of the Virgin Islands would do something that was certainly contrary to established federal law.
You haven't argued in your briefing on either certification or an official act, have you, that official act has some meaning other than what it has for purposes of the federal bribery statute?
Well, I guess what I'm asking this court to do is because the term official act is not defined in the Virgin Islands case law or within the statute, that the section 201 and the case law interpreting 201, mostly McDonald, provides that guidance that this court could find that official act is void for vagueness because it does not contain those definitive elements to guide the courts and to guide the litigants and to guide the juries as to whether there's been a violation of the bribery statute.
Well, here you've got Stephen's testimony about what she did over a course of 6 years. That combined with the case Birdsall, isn't that enough? There's another argument as to whether or not the jury should have been instructed on this. I get that. But forgetting that for a second, isn't that enough for us to determine what's an official act?
Well, I don't think that doesn't determine what an official act is. I think the argument that I'm presenting is that assuming for the sake of argument that there is a duty to report, well, let me put it this way. Is there a duty for a Virgin Islands licensing officer to report violations of federal immigration law to his superior? The argument I'm making is that the Stevens testimony, I've made two arguments. One, that sufficient foundation for that to come in. But if we even just look at what she said, I don't think that definitively shows that there was an official duty on the part of Mr. DeFreitas.
She really testified rather briefly, if I'm correct, to something of a practice, didn't she? And I'd be interested to hear from the government about this. But she didn't testify to official office or department policy, did she?
Well, it appeared not. And as Your Honor points out, the testimony that was elicited by the government with regard to that was very brief. It was almost as if she was testifying in somewhat of a narrative fashion. She was not really directed to provide that testimony, and the verbiage that she used was somewhat vague. And if I can just inject the personal knowledge argument that I've made, even though she testified she was a six-year employee of the agency, she was basically charged with processing applications and accompanying these enforcement officers. So there was no foundational testimony for how she was aware of the practice, if it is indeed a practice. She's certainly not an enforcement officer. She's not a supervisor to whom this alleged violation would be reported. And then another thing that I point out in my insufficient evidence argument is there was really nothing in the testimony of the alleged victim or Ms. Herrera that it was communicated to Mr. DeFreitas that she was in violation of federal immigration law. She talked about how she thought he was looking for her health care card, that he asked for her passport, but she refused to give it. So
yeah, that's really different. They're getting his sufficiency now, but it seems to me there's enough on the record to support the jury's verdict on that. She talked about coming from, she's Dominican, she came from Tortola, came through Tortola. She used the term official papers, and you can argue, well, that doesn't necessarily mean immigration, it might mean something else. But given the deference we have to give to a jury verdict, there's enough there, isn't there? It seems to me a much stronger argument is that the jury was never asked to, was never instructed on the meaning of official act.
Well, I would concede that, Your Honor, but I would point out that if you look at the testimony of Ms. Herrera, she told Mr. DeFreitas she was Dominican. But all of that testimony about how she had gotten married, she had come through Tortola, not through a port of entry, she was telling the prosecutor that and telling the jury that. There was no evidence that she ever told Mr. DeFreitas that. So I think that that's an important point to make.
But she told DeFreitas she shouldn't be working there, and she was only helping out because the normal employee was on vacation. But she wasn't, I'm not sure if she said papers or not, but looking at, when I read in the briefs what she told DeFreitas, it was pretty clear to me that if I were in DeFreitas' position and I heard that, I would be on notice the fact this person probably is not here legally.
Well, what I would submit from the testimony is that it may have shown that she was not licensed to work as a pedicurist in a nail salon.
I think that's right. But the reason she wasn't licensed was because she had no citizenship. She was here illegally. That's why she couldn't get a license.
Well, I think there's more than that, respectfully, Your Honor, that going back to Ms. Stevens, they have to pass an examination and they have to apply for the license. So even though you might be qualified to do manicures, if you're not licensed, you can't do it. So I think that the record doesn't really bear out specifically that Mr. DeFreitas was aware of that she was in the United States illegally.
Let me go back to Ms. Stevens' testimony, which, by the way, there was no objection to her testimony at trial, correct?
Unfortunately, no.
Right. So you can assume there's a 602 was satisfied in terms of her personal knowledge. And she's asked, and she talks about specifically immigration. During the course of an inspection, what is generally done with possible immigration violations that may have occurred? They weren't talking about not having a license to do nails. They were talking about immigration violations. And then she says the enforcement officer would then have to make contact in order to have communication via report to his immediate supervisor. Then the supervisor would make contact with immigration. This was clearly about an immigration situation. And then if you couple that with the statute, the relevant statute as to what their responsibilities are, includes referrals to federal or territorial department or agency. How can that not be an official act?
Well, first of all, even though Ms. Stevens is talking about her understanding of practice within the Department of Consumer Affairs and Licensing about exposed immigration violations, as I was explaining to Judge McKee, the testimony of Ms. Herrera did not demonstrate that she was that she told Mr. DeFreitas that she was here illegally. So I'm looking at it from the perspective of what Mr. DeFreitas knew and if he had an obligation to report an immigration violation that he was not even made aware of. And as far as the statute
was there ever any discussion or argument at the time of trial with respect to the statute that Judge Restrepo has just referred to? That is, 3 Virgin Islands Code Section 272, because he's quoted from subsection A8, that subsection would, if given careful attention, could arguably suggest, at least I suggest it could arguably be read, as still confining the responsibilities to those related to an agent or officer of the department, depending upon how one reads that text in its entirety, the subsection A8 text in its entirety. The including language is what I'm referring to, coming immediately on the heels of receiving and evaluating complaints and initiating their own investigations relating to these matters and take appropriate action. Was there any discussion at all?
There wasn't, Judge Smith, and interestingly, if you look at the closing argument of the prosecutor, there was really no discussion about official act or duty of a licensing officer at all.
Well, neither side provided the court with suggested definitions of official act, did they?
Unfortunately, no. Neither side requested jury instructions that would have specifically defined official act.
Any limiting principles at all, say pursuant to McDonald?
No, none at all. And which is, you know, considering that this court has a very specific jury instruction that I cited in my brief concerning the bribery and official act and definition of official act. But I would like to also point out, as I pointed out in my reply brief, because the government had brought up this statute, Title III Virgin Islands Code 272.8, that the referral to a federal agency relates to all laws relating to the advertising, offering for sale, and the sale of commodities, goods, wares, and services.
That's what I was just asking you about. You have to read the entire subsection because the including language would seem to relate back to that which is the specific charge to the department and its officers, arguably anyway. Let me ask you one additional point here, because you have argued sufficiency, correct?
I have.
Do we view, are we reviewing the sufficiency issue here under plain error?
Well, there are two aspects of the sufficiency that were not raised below, whether official act requires a formal exercise of governmental power, the McDonald issue, and whether there was no pending.
Well, let me get to my bottom line, because that's answering what really was not my specific question. But under Olano, don't you have an easier time attacking what happened here with respect to sufficiency than you would in attacking a failure to request or have instructions given? Isn't the latter a higher hurdle for you under plain error to cross?
Well, I mean, I'm reluctant to completely agree with that, only because the instruction that I submitted should have been given does allow the jury to consider that not every action taken by a public official qualifies as an official act. So it seemed to me that if the jury had been instructed on that, that there's a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different.
I don't have anything else.
And so I think both issues are reversible. I think both issues are plain error.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Duffer. I think we reserve some time for rebuttal. Mr. Sleeper.
Good morning again, Your Honor. Adam Sleeper for the United States. If I could begin, there's a correction that I wanted to make, and then I would touch briefly on certification before getting into the merits. On page 30 of our brief, we had indicated that the defendant, the only one theory was presented at trial, that the defendant sought sexual favors in exchange for not reporting the victim's immigration status to his supervisor. Our arguments were tied solely to the immigration violation, but I think the argument that for not reporting immigration to his supervisor versus immigration generally, our arguments at trial certainly encompass that theory as well.
Mr. Sleeper, could I just ask you a question, a kind of a historical question here for context purposes? The government filed three charges, or there were three charges filed against Mr. DeFreitas, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All three went to a jury, and the jury convicted on only two of them. And interestingly, they found Mr. DeFreitas not guilty on the Section 403 charge. Am I right?
Correct, Your Honor. They found him not guilty on the blackmail charge.
The blackmail charge. Would you agree with me that blackmail was probably a better fit, both legally and factually, here to what occurred? Official act, of course, does still appear in the statute, but it doesn't it seem to address what occurred here? I'm sorry. I thought it was. I think I misspoke. Was it 873 was the not guilty charge, right? The blackmail charge.
Yes, Your Honor. It was count two, the blackmail charge.
Yeah. I apologize for giving the wrong section, but I'm asking this question because the language is under a threat of informing or as a consideration for not informing, which is what would seem to have occurred here. And for whatever reason, the jury came back not guilty on that one, but guilty on the 403 charge.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's probably better explained by the arguments by defense counsel in his closing. With respect to count two, he argued to the jury that there was no indication that the defendant was threatening himself to go to immigration. And he made that argument at closing only to blackmail charge. And that can be found at Supplemental Appendix 199 and Supplemental Appendix 207.
I realize the government called the colleague of Mr. DeFreitas to testify. I don't believe Mr. DeFreitas really put on any defense, at least evidentially. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, I mean, did the government proceed here on a theory that there was some kind of custom or practice to report or refer?
Your Honor, was that express theory enunciated anywhere? I don't believe it was. But is that theory supported by the evidence for sufficiency of the evidence analysis? It is, and it would be our view in light of the acquittal on count two.
Well, how would the jury figure that out if it wasn't argued that way? I mean, even if, especially when, at least by my lights in reading 3VIC section 272, it's not clear to me that there's a statutory duty to do so, to report or refer.
Well, Your Honor, I think it turns on the scope of review here, which is plain error, as I believe defense counsel has acknowledged. You know, if we were ourselves trying to show that there had been no prejudice from the omission of an instruction, we would be in a much more difficult situation. But here, we can look to the acquittal on count two and the arguments that were made on count two to determine what the jury was thinking. And the arguments were regarding immigration. And there were two potential arguments involving immigration encompassed in the evidence. One is that he had violated this in some way by not by blackmailing her in order to not make a direct.
Okay, what was your theory of official act as to the prosecution under and the conviction of Section 403? What was the official act?
Your Honor, I don't think that a theory, if you're asking me what theory was argued to the jury, I can't say that there was a discussion of immigration.
Well, my gracious, we don't even have a jury instruction to them on what an official act is, and nobody argued what it was either?
No.
What's a lay jury supposed to do? This is a term of art that has given the Supreme Court of the United States great difficulty. But at least the Supreme Court has provided some guidance, has provided some bounds, has provided some specifics, even arguably some dictum, and the court provided nothing, and apparently neither the prosecution nor the defense sought any instruction here. And is anything I've just said in what I admit was not really a question inaccurate?
No, Your Honor, I couldn't disagree with anything that was said there.
What about the way the statute is worded? 403, the bribery statute, which is read to you, goes at doing or refusing to do anything and basically for a quid pro quo. 403 is not worded that way. It simply says for doing any official act. It doesn't say for doing any official act or for the promise to withhold any official action. That's what we have here. He wasn't saying that he was willing to, he wasn't basically shaking her down in exchange for doing something. He was saying that he would refrain from doing something if she did him a sexual favor that he was trying to get. 403 does not include language that would include an omission. But aren't you asking us to amend the statute, to put into the statute for doing any official act or for refraining from taking any official action?
Your Honor, two responses to that. At first, it's the government's view that that issue isn't presented in this appeal. That was
he raised it in his brief. I looked this morning. I looked at it. It's in his brief, and you never responded with your brief. It's in his brief. He raises it. It's only a paragraph, but he raised the issue.
Okay, Your Honor. Well, I would also say that while that may be in a federal statute, but not a Virgin Islands statute, and while if we were construing federal statutes, we might view that absence as conspicuous, I think that looking at statutes across jurisdiction, that's not the same, quite the same analysis. And
well, I have no idea what you're saying. You're saying that the Virgin Islands legislature does not know how to draft a statute, but the Congress does?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that when you have a statutory scheme and Congress uses language in one part and in different language in a different part, that can be viewed as significant. What I'm saying is that when you have the Virgin Islands drafting a statute and the United States drafting a statute, it's not the same sort of statutory scheme subject to that analysis.
Well, where does the Virgin Islands, I'm not sure if I follow you. Are you saying that there are other statutes where the Virgin Islands, I guess you're saying that when the VI legislature drafts an act like this, they never ever include the omission as part of a criminal act, and that all they do is punish affirmative actions and not promises to refrain from taking official actions?
No, Your Honor. I'm the point I was making, and this was more of an ancillary point, so I'll move on to the more direct point after, is that because this statute's not being passed by the same sovereign, this isn't a statutory scheme. So the Virgin Islands, so the mere fact that the Virgin Islands legislature used different language than the United States did doesn't necessarily mean they intended something different. Now, I think the greater point is, whether the affirmative act of doing something can also encompass not doing something, presumably, and admittedly, this is not in the record, the defendant would at some point need to file some sort of report. And whether or not it was an affirmative act or refraining.
You're right, it's not in the record. All he has to do is nothing, basically. If he just one does no, files no report, says nothing, that's basically what he's saying. Look, you do me this sexual favor, and I'm going to go about my business. I won't turn you in. He didn't say that he would be filing any kind of any report. And if that's what the situation was, that could have been established through testimony of a supervisor or something of that sort in terms of what the course of business is and get it in through Birdsall. None of that was done here. But you really are asking us to amend the statute.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I would characterize it as amending it, but I think that it's a matter of intent. There's just no reason that the Virgin Islands would have intended to only affect what might be viewed as affirmative versus a fail, affirmative act versus a failure to do something.
But you're aware of the fact that we get intent from what the legislature said in the statute. And all we have before us in terms of their intent is that they are intent on penalizing someone who decides that they're going to extract an emolument, gratuity, reward, whatever that language is, in return, quote, for doing any official act. Not for refusing or refraining to do an official act, but for doing any official act.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree that that's what the statute says. I think that he is is making a decision to not pass along information. He's making an affirmative decision not to. Whether that constitutes an official act.
Well, so now you're really in shaky ground under all the cases. So you're saying the mental process of deciding not to do something becomes an official act. What's going on in his mind is an official act.
Well, Your Honor, under Birdsall, under the question, so we're looking to, is there a settled practice? So it's an analysis of what could...
Birdsall helps you in terms of the immigration law. He's not an immigration officer, but the connection between the immigration laws and the consumer licensing folks, Birdsall bridges that gap. Birdsall doesn't bridge the gap in terms of what's an official act and whether or not failure to act is an action.
Well, Your Honor, I think Birdsall talks to there not needing to be, Birdsall involves an inferior employee doing something that would not otherwise constitute an official act.
Because of the custom and practice. And you've got that.
Correct.
On this record with Stephen's testimony, there's enough there, barely enough, but there's enough there to sustain that inference. I would grant that. You've got that under Birdsall. But that's a different issue.
Yes,
that,
Your Honor.
That just goes to the immigration problem.
Yes, Your Honor. And the point I'm making is that while a decision on something like this may not constitute an ultimate official act, that doesn't mean that a decision on something like this cannot sort of fall into that intermediate process that's considered in Birdsall for purposes of whether it's affirmative or not. If I could speak briefly on certification, the issue with certification here, at least on the official act question, is that this just was not raised below. If the court were to certify this question, I certainly doubt that the court would certify it for plain error to the Virgin Islands Supreme Court. And if the court didn't certify it for plain error, then essentially certification would be being used as a workaround because any holding of law by the VI Supreme Court would then be plain in light of the certification.
Let's get to whatever your bottom line is. Are you saying that this is not really a good vehicle for certification?
Yes, Your Honor. That's our view. We'd also note that the last question, that the void for vagueness question, is a matter of federal law, not a matter of local law, and not appropriately certified. And that the middle two questions are also for the reasons in our brief.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dahlberg, are you reserved some time, I believe?
Yes. Thank you. Because a point was made about the blackmail statute and the fact that there was a conviction, and this may, factor in. I think the government has kind of made an argument that because there was an acquittal on one count, you can't find plain error as to the convictions on the other two counts. Going through the jury instructions, the court instructed the jury that in order for the defendant to be found guilty of blackmail, there's first that the defendant demanded money or another thing of value from the victim. Well, we know from the any fair reading of the testimony shows that he didn't demand money, and other thing of value wasn't defined. I mean, that's going back to what I consider to be the deficiencies in the jury instructions, that none of these terms of art are defined for the jury, so they're kind of left floating, in the wind. And then we get to what I consider to be the prosecutorial misconduct in the closing argument, because there is no theory advanced, as the court was questioning the government's attorney. There was no theory advanced as to, what was the official act and whether it was settled practice, whether it was a statutory duty.
Did the district court's instruction on 873 limit what was received explicitly and only to money? It did not track, it did not track the language of the statute, money, any money or other valuable thing?
It did. As a matter of fact, right. I'm reading from the instruction at page 188 of the transcript. The court said, first, the defendant demanded money or other thing of value from the victim.
Okay.
Money is obviously self-explanatory. Other thing of value is not. And I'm just pointing out that, you know, a lot of these terms of art, legal terms of art, are not defined for this jury, so that they're susceptible to the argument that was made by the prosecutor, which was, you know, Mr. DeFreitas is a bad guy. Don't let him do it again. That this victim deserves justice. Things of that nature, so that the prejudicial tone of the closing argument was not related to anything dealing with the evidence and the relevant evidence to the elements of the charges, but was really just an overly prejudicial argument that I submit was influenced the jury to improperly convict the defendant. So I think my time is up, unless the court has other questions.
We don't. Thank you very much for arguing. Take the matter.
I just ask that the court vacate the convictions.
I'm sorry.
I'm just asking the court vacate the convictions.
Okay. Thank you. We're taking the matter in the